Note, as counselor coming forward for the next matter, our second case of four today, estate of Jeffrey C. Woodard, appellant versus Marion C. Crumry, respondent. Our file number is A230774. We are recording the proceedings, so when you can have a seat when you make yourself comfortable. We are recording the proceedings, so we do ask that you identify yourself for the record when you approach the podium. There is a time clock on the podium, and so keep an eye on that, of course, throughout your comments. And also there's an adjustable button, I think, on the left front, if I recall last time I was looking at it, if you want to move up or down. And so with that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
May it please the court, my name is Carl Christensen. Good morning. I represent the estate of Jeffrey Woodard in this matter. We're here today because this case was dismissed, and everyone knows this case is about a forfeiture. The question before you, and for which we argue you should reverse the lower court, is what do we need to state a claim for that? Here the claim is an unjust enrichment claim, and from this own court's book of standards, you can find that the standard we rely on for a Rule 12 motion for a motion to dismiss is that the case should not be dismissed if it's possible any evidence might be produced consistent with the pleader's theory to grant the relief demanded. As you know, that's the Northern States Power Company case. I believe every brief on for appellant is going to cite that case. Here, the two cases that talk about if there were even a question about what the level, the sufficiency of the pleading that would be required after the Walsh case is, you only need to look at two cases that both the parties cite to. The Zirinsky case, that's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1969, and the Nicollet Restoration case, that's a Minnesota Court of Appeals case, unpublished from 1995. In both of those cases, when they're talking about the unjustness of this kind of scenario, when there's a cancellation of the contract for deed, both of them look to what would have happened if it was performed and what the failure of performance is vis-a-vis the appreciation of the property. That's what they look to for the unjustness of this. And again, those are both cases that were brought with a full factual record. I believe, yeah, they're both summary judgment appeals. But both of those cases, the Zirinsky case, they say in that case there was evidence of the value of the land on the date of the breach. And that was the basis for the unjust enrichment claim. The Nicollet Restoration case, they said that the unjustness was supported because the appreciation demonstrated a fact issue on enrichment. And so it said there, it would have, if that were the basis of the determination of the court, it would have reversed the court. But it says later on, there was no evidence produced to show the other factors. But
Mr. Christian, can I ask you, this might be going back a little bit to a thought you mentioned earlier. In your brief, you make reference to both the respondent and district court's, I think, narrow reading of Fort Dodd, which made clear that in for follow-up action on a cancellation of a contract for deed, there would have to be some alleged moral or fraudulent something of wrongdoing. And I assume that's based on the premise, of course, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that cancellation of a contract for deed, if it happens to and the case law seems to support this, result in a passive increase in value in and of itself doesn't make it morally wrong. And so my question for you is looking at your complaint, and there's no dispute that, and our court has affirmed in the prior decision, the point being is the cancellation was lawful. The violation of the contract was indeed undisputed. Well, it was disputed before. No longer is it disputed. Therefore, the cancellation was lawful. And so my question for you is what more, using the phrase, the quote that you're using in terms of what possible, and I'm looking at paragraph 3 of the complaint, And that pretty much lays out the undisputed facts, at least in part, references the 23 years and references the cancellation and references the increase in value. What more could ever be presented between now and either a summary judgment or a trial, and what is the allegation of the unjustness in that other than it happened?
Well, facts that we would explore is, in the previous case, and we didn't plead this here, but we would explore what was the basis for the Woodard's attempt to actually pay out the value of the contract. What was the basis for the cancellation? Why was grandma canceling against ostensibly her grandson?
That's my question. We know what the basis was, is because there was an illegal transfer, an improper transfer, and so that was the basis for the cancellations. That's kind of what I'm getting at. There wouldn't have been a cancellation if there was no basis to cancel. Isn't that correct?
Well, that would mean that every lawful cancellation would preclude a claim for unjust enrichment.
Well, that's what brings me back to Fort Dodd. You say it's a narrow reading. Isn't that where the law is, that very few cases, the principle is that there is no separate cause of action once that occurs, as long as it was done absent fraud or some obvious wrongdoing?
Well, Fort Dodd is in my opposite because of the facts. But let me answer that question by talking about the cases that actually set the standard, because Fort Dodd doesn't set the standard. The two cases that do are the Zerinsky case, which I previously mentioned, in the Humerding case. And if you'll bear with me, I'll come back to Fort Dodd in a minute. So in Zerinsky was just what we sort of talked about was, is any upside to the canceling party, can you bring an action for unjust enrichment? And Zerinsky, the Court of Appeals said, no, you can't. That's just tough luck. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's wrong. You do have a claim. And they set out the standard as two-prong. They looked at the case law, and the party that canceled was trying to enforce the theory that you need to show some sort of malice or fraud. And the court, then they said in Zerinsky, I'm skipping ahead to the next case. So to the class case, not Humerding. Let me back up here and get this correct. Zerinsky, they look at forfeiture, and they say the law abhors a forfeiture. And there, what it looks at, it doesn't look at any facts other than the measure of damages rule. And what it says is that what they're entitled to, and Humerding cites the same principle, that the defendant who has received money which in equity and good conscience should have been paid to the plaintiff shall pay the money over. So basically, if they get more than they would have gotten under performance of the contract, that's the standard.
Why doesn't the standard come from the Brackey v. Hilders case, which directly dealt with statutory cancellation?
Kloss, the 1968 case is the standard, I believe. That's the one where they said,
that was being applied in Brackey?
I believe so, yeah. Okay. So in Kloss, the question was, and I was mixing up the cases for a minute, so I apologize. And Kloss is the one where they said, you must show fraud or malice. And they said, no. They said the principle was there's no recovery without fraud or malice, and they rejected that. And they specifically said, a cause for action for unjust enrichment may be based on situations where it would be morally wrong for one party to enrich themselves at the expense of another.
And then Brackey expanded on that to say that for a statutory cancellation, unjust enrichment can be based on failure of consideration, fraud, mistake, or situations where it would be morally wrong for one party to enrich himself.
Or to paraphrase, it took those two prongs and sort of put them together. But yes, it echoes the sentiment that it's not, scienter is not the only way you get there. It can be that there's, and again, Zerinsky and Kloss, when read together, are really looking at the harsh result of forfeiture, which is what this case is about, and what all cases would be about in the context of a contract for deed cancellation.
Your theory really is it's in the moral wrongdoing prong of the unjust enrichment exception or separate cause of action. Is that right? It's whether it would be morally unjust or morally wrong for the seller to be able to keep the value of the property at this point, given these specific circumstances. Is that right?
Correct. And I'm grounding that moral wrongdoing in cases where they looked at mere appreciation as the basis for saying that that was enough for there to be a claim. Going back to the court's question about Fort Dodd, and the issue there is if the propriety of the, if there's no wrongdoing you could show because the cancellation was proper, as this court and the Supreme Court, or this court found Woodard won, then there would be no cause of action for unjust enrichment. And again, all of the authority is looking at a full factual record, either in summary judgment or in a post-trial context.
So what is your interpretation, if I'm the trial judge now, and you're making an argument to me this was morally wrong, how would you define that? And is it defined by if the a result of a cancellation to the seller results in something more than a 20% appreciation, passive appreciation?
There's no bright line on what amount of forfeiture.
It's part of my question. Is there any line?
There's no line. And well, that's exactly what...
If there's no line, then what do you need to allege for a cause of action to be actionable for unjust enrichment following a cancellation?
So there's two questions there. What do we need to allege and what do we need to prove, right? What do we need to allege? You just need to say they were unjustly enriched. Everyone knows what we're talking about there.
Fort Dodd would say otherwise, though. That's why I keep coming back to that. To sustain a cause of action, and I realize that was a summary judgment, you must allege. And then it talked about the morally wrong fraud or some other action. I didn't see that in your complaint.
Well, the unjustness, again, from the Zirinsky case and from the other one from this court, Nicollet Restoration, all we need to say is that there was a windfall. That's what the case law says. We need to prove up. We may need to prove up more.
Well, let me ask Judge Sleater's question in maybe a slightly different way. So we held in Gatz that you cannot invoke the theory of unjust enrichment merely because your client made a bad bargain.
Right.
So I think the question for me, and I think this is also what Judge Sleater's trying to get at, is what are the allegations in your complaint that say what happened here was more than just your client entered into a bad bargain?
There's 23 years of a bargain. In the Gatt case, it was an $8,000 investment and a cancellation in less than 3 years.
Well, is it clear from the contract for deed that the prohibition against transfer without consent was intended to apply to this situation, whereas the transfer on death deed? I mean, isn't your complaint and the allegation, your complaint about morally wrong, really specific to this context where the transfer occurred on the death of the buyer, and it's this specific situation where it's the length of time that the payments were made, the transfer occurred on the buyer's death, the transfer was to his son, the grandson of the seller. I mean, aren't those important facts that are part of your complaint that go to your theory of moral unjustness?
Did I answer your question first?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, it does. And in fact, it's the totality of all of those. And then we look at the other authority that shows the unjustness of it. And there's a federal law that actually prescribes this kind of conduct. But we don't need all of that. We can just say that there was a windfall, and that should get us in the door for an equitable claim and a proper pleading. What we have here is, and we've made it pretty...
When you say get through the door, you mean...
To survive a motion to dismiss,
you should be entitled to some limited amount of discovery because you've pled enough facts to be able to investigate whether a windfall occurred.
I should be entitled to discovery, correct.
Yeah.
The court, it would be up to the district court whether it's conducted in stages or if I need to...
What are you going to discover that isn't already known by all the parties?
Just what I mentioned, some things would be the attempts to try to pay off the contract, the history of the payments of the contract, the improvements to the property, the relationship of the parties, if there's any enmity or bad will there, and anything else that, quite frankly, that I would uncover in the process of the investigation of the claim. But the question here today is, and going back to Your Honor's question from the beginning, is what does Woodard 1, what impact does it really have? And our argument is none. The propriety of the cancellation is not a basis for preventing the unjust enrichment claim. And all of the cases we cite to say that. And so
can I follow up, by the way, your last? I didn't quite fully understand. Attempts to pay off, wouldn't that have been a defense to the cancellation?
Well, there's an equitable defense, too, because if we follow Zirinsky, and it's the measure of damages rule that we should be looking at to see whether or not they were unjustly enriched, the measure of damages rule is rooted in the value or the benefit of the unperformed contract to the parties. So if you can show that there was the amount was arguably small because they're at the end of the contract, and if you can show on top of that that they intended to pay that off, I think there's another equitable argument that if the measure of damages rule is the real ruler by which we're judging the propriety of this forfeiture, and they actually tried to pay that, I think there's another equitable argument that the inability for the canceling party to accept the money goes to the equities as well. I see I have 4 seconds left. I'll reserve the rest of my comments on rebuttal. Thank you.
Very well, thank you. And counsel for respondent, you may approach, identify yourself, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Brian Nimchek, and I represent the defendant, Marion Crumry, who is present in the courtroom today. As has been stated repeatedly in the opening portion of this argument, this is the second time that this matter, this dispute, and disputes surrounding this contract for deed have been before this court. And as with the last time, the district court's decision should be affirmed. Now, the issue here, of course, is whether a post cancellation, unjust enrichment claim, a special kind of unjust enrichment claim, can exist under the facts alleged in the complaint. And one thing I want to emphasize at the outset is the reason why, the fundamental underlying legal reason why such claims are limited to narrow factual circumstances. Equity cannot jump in when the parties have a valid, enforceable contract between them governing the same subject matter. It just can't. That's why the courts are looking in these cases for some kind of extra contractual moral wrongdoing akin to fraud, similar to fraud.
But isn't this a pretty narrow factual circumstance here? Isn't this particular situation pretty unusual? I mean, a majority of these types of cases arising as unjust enrichment claims after a failed attempt to challenge the cancellation of the contract for deed or where there was a default on paying. Where there was a default on paying on the contract for deed that led to the cancellation versus another provision like this, a provision against transfer without consent. Wouldn't you agree that this is a pretty unusual circumstance, that this is the reason for the enrichment that's being alleged?
No, Your Honor, I would not agree. A breach of contract is a breach of contract, whether it's Section A, Section B, or Section C of that contract. If the parties agreed to the sort of remedies that would be available in the event of a breach of a contract, and the other party invokes that remedy upon breach, it shouldn't matter for purposes of determining whether there's an outside equitable remedy available, which kind of breach happened. And here the breach was considered material. It was considered material by several courts. It's the sort of breach that gave my client the both bargained for remedy of cancellation and a remedy specifically blessed by the legislature in statute. If you follow certain steps, you get to do this as a contract for deed seller. When my client saw that there was a breach, she and her then husband, who has since passed away, proceeded with the appropriate statutory procedure and invoked their cancellation remedy and got that remedy. That is, if you could go outside of that remedy, that bargained for, statutorily blessed remedy, by just saying that, well, it's unfair, and by some amorphous equitable standard, we should be able to claw back the results of that bargained for, statutorily blessed remedy, it wouldn't be much of a remedy. And it is something that longstanding law governing the place of equitable claims in connection with situations where the parties have a contract just cannot override the the provisions of that contract. That's why you get these lines of cases that have been discussed that talk about or that insist that there be some kind of tort-like outside wrongdoing for there to be even be any kind of claim at all for unjust enrichment where you got this bargain for a remedy that occupies the field. You have
but
to go off of that field.
Most of those cases deal with summary judgment and not the motion to dismiss. I mean, when I was looking through the cases, I think the only case that dealt with a motion to dismiss was actually the Brackey case. It seems like most of these cases, you at least, you know, if you meet the Rule 12 pleading standard, you at least get to the summary judgment stage before some of these, you know, more merits issues are ultimately decided,
yes,
given the liberal pleading standard in Minnesota.
Your Honor, that's a fair observation. I can only assume that such cases were properly pleaded or no one brought the Rule 12 motion to dismiss or the law wasn't quite perhaps as settled as it is now on the question. But
you don't disagree that there are cases where there is statutory cancellation or cancellation of a contract where there has been success in terms of bringing an unjust enrichment claim. So really from your brief, I don't think you disagree that that is something that can be pled. You disagree under the facts of this particular case, but that is a valid claim in Minnesota.
Absolutely.
And so I think the real question is whether appellant has pled enough facts taken as true for this to survive Rule 12, as opposed to, you know, some of your, some of your arguments more related to Woodard 1. And so I think my question is there are some allegations about the care and maintenance that appellant made to this property over the course of 25 years. And my question is, why isn't that allegation sufficient to say that there might have been some appreciable improvement to this property enough to survive a motion to dismiss?
Your Honor, all of the maintenance specifically described, and it is specifically described, as is the what was allegedly done wrong by my client, which was just exercising her right under the contract. But the improvements, such as they were, are specifically described and are only the things explicitly required by the contract itself. They made payments under the contract. They paid the taxes. They maintained the place. That's required under the contract, too. In fact, there's a part of the contract that says if you want to make improvements of $5,000 or more, you got to get our permission. And they didn't plead that anything like that ever happened. There's no allegation in the complaint of any sort of improvement that goes beyond the scope of what the parties agreed to in the contract. And when you're talking about an enrichment that's supposedly unjust, it would have to go outside or beyond what's contemplated by the parties in that contract, or the bargain is meaningless. There has to be an equitable outlet only in those sort of extreme circumstances.
I might follow up Judge Larson's question and ask it a different way, and this kind of goes in part to, I mean, it looks like appellants agreeing that moral, the threshold showing, as Fort Dodd talks about, moral wrongdoing, what is their claim? Then let me ask this: what do you believe is missing from the specific allegations in the complaint that would equal moral wrongdoing? What do you think it would be necessary to satisfy the Rule 12 standard?
Sure, Your Honor. It would need to be something akin to the Anderson case, the Anderson v. Delisle case, which I think is the leading case on this issue. Sets forth the sort of facts that would be necessary to prevail on this narrow sort of claim. You know, there it was a party, a buyer who never actually took possession of the property, a seller that they had actually established at trial. The jury found that the seller had known about the buyer's lack of ability to perform, had known about the extreme likelihood of an immediate breach. In fact, I think the first payment check bounced, and still let the buyer onto the property to make apparently a $47,000 improvement in the form of erecting a building on the property. Under those circumstances, the appellate court affirmed a jury trial finding that yes, that was moral wrongdoing. There was some degree of malevolence, of knowledge, of of fraud or moral wrongdoing similar to fraud outside of the contract, you know, improvements beyond what was required by the contract that was compensable under those circumstances, or at least it was within the jury's discretion to award those sorts of damages, and in this case, the value of the improvements.
But isn't that just one example?
To the buyer.
So, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Isn't that just one example that would fall under the fraud category, you know, fraud, mistake, or moral wrongdoing? And moral wrongdoing is admittedly a pretty amorphous term. I think we've separately defined it as conduct that's unconscionable by reason of a bad motive or where the result induced by the conduct would be unconscionable. And so, you know, maybe there's not allegations in the complaint at this point that there was a bad motive on the part of the sellers, but looking at whether the result is unconscionable in this circumstance, maybe might not survive summary judgment, but at this point, with the allegations pled, is there really a clear statement in Minnesota law that these facts don't rise to, or can't, no possible evidence could be produced to prove that this result is unconscionable under these circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'll switch to kind of the what we know moral, you know, fraud or conduct similar to fraud or moral wrongdoing is not. And the cases for Dodd, Hammerding are crystal clear on this. It's not just that there was a breach and I, as the seller, exercised my right to call them on the breach and get the property back, the bargain for a remedy. We know that it is not just that, and that is all that's alleged in the complaint. They say it specifically. She capitalized on a technical breach. I think counsel said it. Those are the breaks. If you agree to something like that, and that's how it has to be. If we're going to have this cancellation remedy, we can't have this amorphous. If it's morally wrong, I guess the cancellation remedy doesn't work, or you have to give back everything because of it. You know, the cancellation remedy is a powerful remedy, no doubt, but it's something blessed by the legislature for a reason. Contract for deeds serve a purpose. They're something that self-finance or seller financed sales are out there for a purpose in the marketplace, and the remedy of cancellation allows those sorts of sellers to agree to different terms, to charge less in interest, to enter into a transaction they otherwise wouldn't. And that's what the legislature wanted when they passed this law allowing them.
But that's a very good argument in the first action, right? I mean, and your client prevailed in that action in an equitable, unjust enrichment action. Why does that still defeat the allegations in the complaint, presuming all of them to be true and having to show that there's no possible evidence that would indicate there's unjust enrichment here based on a moral unjustness theory?
Because, Your Honor, the result of the rule proposed by the Woodard estate is that any time, you know, absent some kind of allegation of, like Anderson, of the sort of intentional moral wrongdoing or fraud or something similar to fraud, a party would just be allowed, a disappointed buyer, under any circumstances where they just say it was unfair or immoral that they had to give the property back, can get into court and get the money back that they paid or the appreciated value of the property, which by contract and by law is supposed to go to the non-breaching party. That remedy would become illusory if equitable considerations could just jump in and result in a party who successfully cancels a contract because there was a breach to have to give back some or all of the money that they, I guess, obtained or the benefit they obtained by exercising their contractual remedy.
I'm sorry to interrupt. One follow-up question for you, it's tangential. Is the district court's reliance on extra complaint information in its order granting and its memorandum?
The district court's reliance on
extra complaint information, that is information arising from Woodard 1, is that enough for us to reverse on? Because the district court seemed to go beyond the four corners of the complaint in its analysis of whether or not dismissal was appropriate at this stage by looking at Woodard 1 and the facts of Woodard 1.
I would say, Your Honor, and I believe Your Honor is referencing maybe the last paragraph of the district court's complaint, where there's some commentary about the status or the history of the proceedings and some commentary on the policy involved. And I would say that that is not integral to the decision the court made, which was based on all the cases we've been discussing and the record and the deficiencies in the complaint. There were policy arguments made by everyone in that case, and that was the court responding to those policy arguments by talking about a court of appeals decision. The court can talk about that and cite that. There's nothing about Rule 12 that prevents consideration of precedent. So the court was making some policy observations. I'd call it dictum. But it was not integral or necessary to the court's resolution of the case on Rule 12 based on the things that were alleged and not in the complaint. And the court, in its other six pages of its opinion, deals with those issues at length. It's not a situation where it rested its opinion on that sort of policy commentary or dictum near the end of the decision. There was a full and fair analysis of all the issues presented by this unjust enrichment post-cancellation claims, and the court came down correctly, as we view it, in favor of dismissal.
Can I ask one question?
Which means you can answer it as well, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Based on your reading of the cases, would the outcome be different if appellant had put in one allegation that said something to the effect of, your client, had bad intent when they decided to pursue cancellation?
Would the Rule 12 outcome be different? It would be a closer case. It would matter, I think, if it were a situation where they didn't also specifically say and rely on the idea that she is relying upon a technical breach and capitalizing on it, that the courts have said specifically, if the breach is the issue, then that can't support a claim for post-cancellation unjust enrichment.
Would it be different if the allegation was that your client has unjustly benefited from improvements under $5,000 that were made over the course of 25 years?
Those are the sorts of things that would very much help.
This
state
is obviously hypothetically. I'm just trying to tease out where you think the Rule 12 analysis intersects with the case law with regard to unjust enrichment. Because really the question is, has appellant pled enough? It's not really about the actual facts as you, right, as your client believes them to exist. It's what's actually pled. And
yes,
so would those have been sufficient to survive a Rule 12?
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand and agree that this is not a Rule 9 case. There's not a heightened pleading standard. We don't have Iqbal and Twombly in Minnesota. Something like that, allegations like that would go a long way to meeting the Rule 12 standard. Of course, they're not there. But here, it's extremely important that it's the wrongdoing is expressly connected to the allegation that it was unfair to take advantage of a breach and call the breach and exercise my contractual remedies just because there was a technical breach, as they put it. And that just can't be the reason. That can't be the moral wrongdoing. That can't be the supposed fraud under binding Minnesota law. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very well. Thank you, counsel, for appellant. You'll now have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And I might take advantage. I'm going to, again, follow up Judge Larson's question. Point to me what statement or allegation in the complaint that you believe makes the threshold showing of either fraud, mistake, or moral wrongdoing.
The appreciation, we lay out the amount of payments, the duration of the payments, and then the appreciation of the property.
So it does come back. In Europe, do you believe the law supports a moral wrongdoing when a canceled contract results in increased value that the seller, is that the standard or the number of payments a buyer makes before a breach occurs? Is somehow there's a line between those two creates a moral wrongdoing?
Those weren't the only allegations, but the answer is yes. And Zirinsky says that. That's
the
lead case. That's the lead case that set up unjust enrichment as a remedy for a canceled contract for deed. And Zirinsky is the one that said the inequitable nature of it, it can be based merely on appreciation, basically that they got more than they would have gotten if the contract was performed. And that case has not been, there's no yellow flags, there's no red flags. That case is still good law. And all the other cases, and Kloss even, are restating the standard that came out of there, but that standard is based on unlawful forfeiture, which we all know the law abhors. And so that's where we go back, where we're now looking at the generational effect of cases and wondering, well, what is the bedrock principle? And that's, and in fact, they use that language. The bedrock principle is that the law abhors forfeitures, and it's the measure of damages rule.
Can I ask you, again, looking at Fort Dodd, in applying Zirinsky, or at least addressing, said in Zirinsky the court held, and that's what you just stated, the court implied in dicta that a claim might exist where the vendee had evidence of property appreciation to show that the vendor had suffered no actual damages. No Minnesota court has yet adopted Zirinsky. Well, so my question is that really an accurate statement of the law that appreciation can equal a moral wrongdoing?
Well, I would disagree that no court has adopted that. But going back to Fort Dodd, so in Fort Dodd,
I'm just reading from the Fort Dodd case,
right,
so we said that.
But the facts of Fort Dodd give you context for that quote, and that is in Fort Dodd, the vendee got the payments back, and then they brought a claim for appreciation on top of that. And the court said, well, you got the payments back, so you can't really have both. And so Fort Dodd is distinguishable because those aren't the facts in this case. And if there is even if Zirinsky is authority that the court has not adopted, which I don't agree with because most of these cases cite to it, this is not the case where there is a forfeiture.
So my only point though is, how do we address that? We've got Fort Dodd, and it goes on to say that. Besides, no Minnesota court has yet adopted Zirinsky without a threshold showing by the defaulting, without a threshold showing by a defaulting vendee of fraud, mistake, or moral wrongdoing. So I read from that the moral wrongdoing cannot be simply an allegation of appreciation.
Well, there are other allegations of moral wrongdoing, including the loss of improvements. But let's go back to pleading now, because this court did look at appreciation as the unfairness in Nicollet Restoration, the unpublished case I referenced before. So while it didn't explicitly adopt Zirinsky, it surely looked at forfeiture and the tenets of forfeiture and to look towards the unjustness of the claim. And again, that's a summary judgment case. So we're talking about pleading here. I've got 1 minute to get a couple other points in, and that is the Anderson case.
Can I ask you, I'm sorry,
go
Mr.
ahead.
Christensen, to jump in?
Oh, I love when you jump in.
Just to follow up on Judge Sleeter's question, your counterpart focused on paragraph 3 of the complaint, which is the paragraph that you appear to be alleging exactly why the Crumries were unjustly enriched. And the way I read that allegation is it wasn't simply regarding the appreciation and value of the property or any improvements made to the property, but it was also, and it wasn't just that there was any general material breach that led to the cancellation, it was the specific type of breach here where the breach occurred, the transfer occurred on the death of Mr. Woodard. The transfer did not occur before that point, it occurred on the date of his death, and the property was transferred to his son. And under these circumstances, these specific factual circumstances, that's what you've alleged to be moral wrongdoing, that all of the payments made and the appreciation is lost on the date of death, which is, I think, and this is outside the complaint, kind of an unusual circumstance where a buyer in a contract for deeds situation predeceases the seller. And usually the reason you're contracting over a long period of time for these in these situations, and it may be the risk that your counterpart argues, but it's because you expect that you're going to outlive the seller or at least live to make all the payments, right? So my question for you, is that an accurate reading of the complaint? Is that the allegations that, in addition to the appreciation, would fall under moral injustice or moral wrongdoing?
I see I've run out of time. May I answer
your
question?
You certainly can answer.
Yes, that and it was the grandson's home as well. I had 2 points to make. May I make those
two points quickly? Yes.
Let's talk about the Anderson case. So yes, the wrongdoing is more than just appreciation. All I'm saying is appreciation is enough to get you in the door for surviving a motion to dismiss. But yeah, the moral wrongdoing is much, much greater than that. The 2 points are the Anderson case. If they had made payments, even though they weren't financially able to, if they borrowed money, begged, borrowed, and stole to make those payments, and they made them for 27 years and then missed a payment and the contract was then canceled, would Anderson then not be morally wrong because they made the payments? Because that's the implication of the defendant's reading of that case. And the second point is, and the last point I'd like to rest on, defendants argued that what this case really is about is alleging some kind of tort-like outside wrongdoing, and that cannot be what this case is about. That's a much higher pleading standard. It starts to get us towards special pleading standards in Rule 9. All we need to say is that this is an unjust enrichment claim and give the basis of that claim to get in the door and let the determination of moral wrongdoing and let the determination of inequities play out for the fact finder. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions this morning and for your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement. We will be issuing a ruling within 90 days. You have a good day.